So the attack happened in November.
The attacks happened in November. Around late December, I think beginning of January, I get a message from a friend saying, this attack never happened. And I can't go into very specifics of who I got, like, but I'm not the only one who got this message.
Mm-hmm.
And clearly, people in the police have known that this attack did not happen since the day after. So this is also the thing. If you want to fake anything of an attack or anything at all, don't do it in the U-Bahn. Just like, you know, if you want to be attacked, you want to be claimed that something happened to you in the street, in the park, not in the U-Bahn.
Welcome to the Heist Podcast. I'm Ben Schumann-Stoller. This episode is part of the three-episode drop we're doing to kick off the whole podcast. We're doing three episodes at once. So this episode features Yossi Bartal, but we're also publishing conversations with Heba Jamal about Palestinian life in Berlin and with Ben Miller about the AFD and weaponizing their queer politics. So please check out those episodes on the feed. But yeah, this episode is with Yossi Bartal, and it's about a faked attempted murder in Berlin that happened earlier this year. You'll hear Yossi in conversation with Peter Matthews, a founding editor of Heist. And for me personally, I especially found it interesting in the conversation hearing Yossi talk about some of the history of the Arabic language cultural institutions in Neukölln, here in Berlin, and how they've become like an interface for city politicians to contact and engage with these Arab-speaking communities. But the conversation also goes into some of the problems in journalism in Germany today, and maybe most importantly, how German media reacts when one of their media darlings is actually in the wrong. You can read Yossi's feature about this faked murder at heistberlin.com, where you can also sign up to Heist. But for now, here's Peter Matthews and Yossi Bartal.
Well, one of the things we've wanted to do at Heist is bring stories that have been reported elsewhere to our audience. And one of the ones which caught our attention was an article in Taz by Yossi Bartal. I think it was called The Storyteller, which focused on a director of a school in Neukölln. Anyway, Yossi Bartal is here. Could you introduce yourself and tell us, who are you?
My name is Yossi Bartal. I live in Neukölln actually since 20 years. I am originally from Jerusalem, and I have become a journalist in recent years, mainly because I was interested in bringing investigations and opinions to German journalism that I thought were not very visible. A lot of investigations, a lot of things that pop up in German news tend to be, in my eyes, quite fascinatingly wrong.
Uh-huh.
And these kind of figures that are celebrated a lot of times, where anyone who actually knows something, comes from the region those people come from, have a bit of an understanding of geopolitics, notice something a little bit off. But somehow those figures might be celebrated in German media very much as courageous, as quite extraordinary people. And that is actually the story that we have in front of us.
Yeah, well, when I read it, I couldn't believe it. Like, it was, you read it and then it gets stranger and stranger and more alarming. So, yeah, and can you just tell us a little, how did you become a journalist?
Well, I was quite active in different left-wing groups, also working on Palestine, Israel, anti-Semitism, racism, and very much intrigued by the way the German media depicts and work on those issues. And one of the problems that I see a lot in investigative journalism in Germany, and not only in Germany, a lot of time in big mainstream media, is that investigative journalism tends to be a lot of time working together with the state, getting things from the secret services, working together with powerful figures, and a lot of time not asking or questioning them.
Yeah, I mean, that kind of like aggressive consensus in the German media landscape is definitely something that we're very aware of and have kind of experienced here. But let's go into this case, because I really think everyone should find out about it. And it was such a extraordinary circumstance. So it involves this director of a German Arabic school in Neukölln, the Ibn Khaldun School, I think, and a guy called Udhaifa al-Mashhadani. And at the end of last year, I think he reported an assassination attempt. Can you just tell me at that time, like, what was the news? What was the reported thing? What happened? Who was the presumed attacker? And how did the Berlin politicians and the Berlin establishment react to this assassination attempt?
Mm-hmm. So what we have in November 2025 is starting with a Facebook post by Hudefa El-Mashadani claiming to have been attacked in the U-Bahn in Neukölln, and that he was thrown in front of a running train
trying to push him in front of a train,
a clear attempted murder by any accounts, but by only his account, but clearly by this account, it was very clearly an attempted murder. The news spread out, of course, very fast. Not everyone knew who was that person, although in
the
local...
No
one knew who was the attacker. The only thing that he was saying, like Hudefa El-Mashadani claims, that the attacker was wearing a Palestinian scarf, a kafia, a red one, and that this attack came as part of a political intimidation against him for his work against anti-Semitism.
Mm-hmm.
That was his
version. As a director of this school, he'd been known to support work on combating anti-Semitism and so on. Right? He would been famous as...
So this is the interesting thing. Not a lot of people knew who was that person. Actually, it was a bit known in Berlin local politics. His name already stood up. In recent 2 years, actually only in 2024 and 25, that person, El-Mashadani, is a person that was organizing events together with the Israeli embassy. When we say combating anti-Semitism, we need to understand combating anti-Semitism in the German understanding, the German mainstream understanding of the word, is like making pro-Israeli activities. So he did organize meetings with Israeli youth in Neukölln, with the Israeli embassy. He did speak in pro-Israeli demonstrations. He was an Iraqi, Mashadani comes from Iraq, and his story was that he was always active against extremism, also in his country, and he came here as a refugee and fleeing actually Islamism and like Islamic attacks against him, and he came here to continue his fight for democracy and liberalism.
So the idea was that he'd been targeted for this work.
Like, exactly. And there were actually, so it's not the first time that he is the target of attack. There was, as much as we know, one clear case where graffiti was put on the school with red triangles, which is used by pro-Palestinians, like Palestinians, as kind of a form of a threat and as a Hamas symbol. And there were also Arabic language graffiti threatening him personally, calling him a traitor. We know of one event that was in the media. There were other complaints to the police. We are not sure if all of them are correct. One case is clear that is not correct. So we are very unclear today about the details.
All right. So let's say the attack happens, and then how does everybody react? What's the response?
So of course the attack happens, and as any other cases, and this is something that happens quite a lot in Berlin in the last years. Whenever there is an attack or a threat or, let's say, a very problematic image that comes up, the media reaction, when it's against people who are considered to be pro-Israeli, the media reaction is quite fast and the political reaction is very fast. So we see all of the media reports about it, really, from like Neues Deutschland and Taz till the right wings. It's not just in Berlin. It will be national news. Politicians, of course, show solidarity with the person. There is other organizations will show solidarity with the person. So there is always like this very big coming together. And we had those cases before when there were posters against journalists, for example, pro-Israeli journalists, when there was attacks against there was an attack against one Jewish student. Some of these cases we know who were behind them, some of the cases we don't know who were behind them, but usually whenever someone is attacked, there is a big wave of solidarity. And clear, specifically talking about, like, we need to deal with the rising anti-Semitism and the rising threat coming from the authoritarian left or from the Islamist scene or the pro-Palestinian groups. It could be different names, but in general it will be about mobilizing support for the person, but also mobilizing support for more repressive politics against pro-Palestinians. So this reaction clearly came and was dominating the news. The interesting thing is that the police was actually quite quiet about this issue the days that followed.
Oh, interesting. So, I mean, I think Kai Wegner, the mayor, gives him a, or like condemns the attack, a cowardly attack as well. And, but the police, you're saying, immediately seemed not to be as...
Not immediately, but in the following days, mm-hmm. It seems like the police and parts of the media itself seems to be less interested in the case.
Interesting.
It is an attempted murder. So it's quite interesting. Supposedly, it was an attempted murder. So it is quite interesting to see who was, after a few days, quietly not commenting anymore on mm-hmm. this issue.
I'm interested also in some of the posts that he was making, like...
Maybe I want to go a little bit back and like speak a bit about what's going on here in Neukölln with this case. So we have, like, of course, this case of an Arab-speaking, an Iraqi former refugee or refugee becoming a pro-Israeli activist. And this is, mm-hmm. of course, something that I think is, first of all, something that people react to as very much interested, bewildered, and... It's good to go back a bit and to understand what is this neighborhood and what are we talking about? I mean, I guess most of the listeners know Neukölln as a very Arab neighborhood. Neukölln became more or less the center of the Arab community in Berlin, in West Berlin, already in the 80s. The school that we are talking about, the Ibn Khaldun School, is actually one of the first Arab associations in West Berlin. It was founded in 1974 by Arab migrants, students, a lot of them from different countries, like from Iraq, from Syria, from Sudan, from Palestine, Lebanon. It is actually a beautiful association that was created in order to teach Arab kids who were, at the time, we're talking about the 70s, there were just a few here, to teach them their mother tongue. And also to give them some cultural lessons on Arab culture, and actually just be a home for the very small Arab community at the time. And that school existed since the 70s with sometimes dozens, sometimes hundreds of students, and became part of Neukölln also in the 90s and the 2000s. It moved there. We have this kind of Arab organizing, organic Arab organizing that is going on in Neukölln, and a growing Arab community, right? Like in the 80s, many people from Lebanon come here after the civil war, Palestinians and people from the south, a lot of Shia Lebanese. And of course, we have more and more waves, more students coming. And as we know, the big wave of refugees in then 2015, to which Mashadani was part of. By the way, Mashadani came here as well, as much as we know, in 2016, the beginning of 2016, as part of that big wave of refugees. So this school and a lot of other associations, and I think this is like the interesting thing that we can see in Neukölln, is that we have a lot of those kind of cultural associations. We have the Iraqi Community Association for a while. We have this association, Kulturvereine, this kind of networks of organization, usually led by men who gather some support in their own communities and also show support, and are usually used by the political establishment in Neukölln as kind of ways to go into those communities. We're talking about a way of governmentality in the neighborhood, which is very interesting, of a very patriarchal way of controlling the migrant community. We know that there's crime. We know that there's a lot of problems in the neighborhood. There is also many adolescents. The question of like Arab delinquency or migrant delinquency is not new. In Germany, it's discussions in the 90s, in the 2000s. And Neukölln was always in the forefront of this fight against delinquency or bad migration, already with a mayor that many of the people listening would not know, but is actually quite known in German politics, known as Buschkowski. His name was Buschkowski, and he was already the mayor in the 2000s, being very strong-handed.
The mayor of Neukölln.
Mm-hmm. The next mayor of Neukölln was Giffey.
Yeah,
which
became the mayor of Berlin.
The mayor of Berlin, and now it is Martin Hickel, who is also all of them from the SPD.
Yeah,
all of them social democrats, and all of them are tough-handed. They're tough on crime.
Right, they're sort of on the right wing of the SPD.
Exactly, mm-hmm. The right wing of the SPD, which is quite strong or was quite strong in Neukölln, and they create this kind of form of governmentality in the neighborhood of like, we will talk with those Vereine, we will talk with those Arab men, usually in their 40s, 50s, 60s, with a little belly. And this is how we show that we are in contact with these people. And this is how we try to organize things and quiet things down. And I would say this kind of like way of working was, in one hand, a lot of repression, also like a lot of police work. But in the other hand, this kind of like dialogue with the community. And this is where Mashodani comes in.
Mm-hmm.
So what happens in the 2000s, he's coming here in 2015,
mm-hmm.
and he...
Because he's going to end up as the director of this of this school, but this is his this is how he got there, kind of.
Yeah, exactly.
Thing.
One has to say exactly, maybe it's also, we say school all of the time, it is a Verein. It is a private association with no control by the state. There is no public money in it, actually, or just a little bit since Mashodani became manager, but not. It is a total private association controlled by Mashodani nowadays. So mm-hmm. he's the head of it, and the people in the board of that association are aligned with him.
Uh-huh.
So it's also important. We say school, people say school, it sounds like something more important than it is. It is only a FAO. In the end, eingetragene Verein. So, Mashodani gets here in the 2015s, like many others, and he becomes active, like many others that come, and goes to this school, somehow has contact there because the old manager is also an Iraqi. Mm-hmm. And somehow they become very good friends. The old manager is getting older and weaker, and he actually also passed away in 2023. And Mashodani actually start taking over the school. In the same time, he's organizing events in Neukölln. He's very much from the beginning in close contact with the mayor of Neukölln, Martin Hickel.
Mm-hmm.
This is the time of Corona, where, you know, there's also like trying to approach the migrant communities quite a lot. From Hickel, it's also important, although Hickel is Aryan, one of like a person that is clearly very pro-Israeli. He's also trying to have like some Arabs on his side, right? Like it is Neukölln. And so there's a friendship that starts to happen. We also see like, you know, they're making there's even a photo online.
There's
of
photos of them traveling around.
Traveling together. Around. He's making there's a beautiful like Martin Hickel's celebrating his birthday with them. They made a photo. They made a cake with the photo of Hickel and Mashodani on it.
For the mayor's birthday.
For the mayor's birthday.
That's nice.
It's very sweet. It's actually a nice friendship, one could say. a bit of a bromance. In Neukölln. In the same time, El Mashodani is continuing being active with like other Arab communities and is talking online. He's also writing articles before and after. He is, how should I say it, not really interested in Israel or Palestine so much. He's, actually, when he talks about Israel or Palestine, he sounds like, I would say, the normal Arab Berliner. So quite critical.
Right. So... there's that change of his stance after October 7th where he starts to make a more explicitly pro-Israeli...
Exactly.
More pro-Israeli position. Is that when this targeting of him, some of which is obviously real in the form of graffiti and messaging, and some of which seems now to have been inflated or invented?
Yeah.
But can you describe, the targeting of him and how that plays out?
So... after October 7th, this happens, first of all, then in 2024, there is this event that he does together with the Israeli embassy. There are more and more critical voices in Neukölln. There is a WhatsApp message that was being sent around in Arabic claiming that he is doing Zionist things and that he is betraying the Arab cause. No threats, as much as I know, but like, you know, clearly saying this guy is not legit, criticizing him for what he's doing. Of course, people who knew him before and were working with him, a lot of them also Palestinians, cut ties with him.
Right.
And what I would see there is he becomes closer and closer to what I would say are the institutions of Staatsräson in Germany, which is...
Explain Staatsräson quickly.
Staatsräson is just it's the idea of German support for Israel as being enshrined in the German state.
Of, almost the raison d'etre or the reason for being of the German state being support for Israel in some kind of way. So, and it's, I think it's even interesting, we don't exactly have to get into it, but it's interesting that there are sort of institutions which would more explicitly like... enforce that position or try and make sure that everyone's maintaining that position. But he seems to become aligned, you're saying, after October 7th with some of these institutions that are sort of taking this particular line of
exactly. Like he's being interviewed by specific journalists. He's also going to participating in some demonstrations, as we said, at least one demonstration, a pro-Israeli demonstration. And he claims that the school is very much talking about the school. He's always talking as the schoolmaster. It's called the Deutsche Arabische Schule, which is it's an Arab school. It's a school for Arabic language, working in the weekends. And he also more and more uses to call himself a doctor or a professor. which is also quite fascinating.
That's very German, isn't it?
Exactly. This is also like, you know, in Germany, a lot of times, I think this is the best integration. A lot of people do need to, in order to speak publicly, you need to show that you have academic credentials. And people tend to use, you know, I'm zertifiziert von, I have this diploma. It's, you know, it's a way to do it. And of course, he noticed that when he says, I'm Professor Doctor, people take him even more seriously.
So, yeah, exactly. Real integration into the German society.
Where exactly and how did he become a professor and a doctor is a fascinating story by itself. He claims on his website, he claimed on his website till we asked him, got a doctor title from a university in Texas, from the Rice University. He claims to have studied, always focusing on extremism and terrorism. He claims a lot of things in his biography, also working for state authorities. You know, he becomes this kind of a person, a personality that speaks with the authority of a professor, that speaks the authority of an Arab, that knows Islam, that knows the extremists, that knows the problems. And he repeats very clearly the talking points of what I would say is the Israel lobby or people who are very aligned with the Israel lobby in Germany and in Berlin.
I mean,
and
some of those things I think I saw in your report that he welcomes a new Israeli era in the Middle East. Yeah. That's one of his statements. I want to go back to the attack and I want you to describe it. When you were reading about it, when did you really start to have suspicions?
Yeah. Okay. I had suspicions about this person before. I heard his name. I asked some people around. Something that most journalists don't do is to speak with Arab people in Neukölln. I asked him, hey, what do you know about this guy? What is going on? And when I heard about the attack, the first thing I thought was, shit, like, this is really bad. We have a person which I might politically dislike, and I might be very questionable about what he's doing, but of course, trying to kill someone is not a good thing. And honestly, I think that in this time right now and like the tensions that are going on in Berlin, I can't rule out the fact that someone will try to be very violent towards someone that they describe as a Zionist and is probably, you know, very pro-Israeli. And we know that violence exists. And we know that this kind of violence usually leads to more oppression and is very unhelpful for anyone who's trying to advance Palestinian human rights in town. So my first reaction was, shit, like, this doesn't sound good. And I really hope that it's no one that that no one's involved that is somehow, you know, important in Palestinian structures or something like this. And then I didn't think about it too much, to be honest.
And so the attack happened in November.
The attacks happened in November. Around late December, I think beginning of January, I get a message from a friend saying, this attack never happened. And I can't go into very specifics of who I got, but I'm not the only one who got this message. Clearly, people in the police have known that this attack did not happen since the day after.
Yeah, because they would have gone and got the footage.
They have gone. So this is also the thing. If you want to fake anything of an attack or anything at all,
Don't do it in the U-Bahn.
Just like, you know, if you want to be attacked, you want to be claimed that something happened to you in the street, in the park, not in the U-Bahn.
Yeah.
And when I heard that, I went back and read a big interview that was done with Mascheleini for the Süddeutsche Zeitung. It was a whole reportage. It was page number 3 in the Süddeutsche Zeitung. It's a big thing. Torsten Schmitz was like a journalist.
The Süddeutsche Zeitung, they're a big paper. They'd published the Snowden files. They're like a big deal.
Exactly. They're like very serious.
Yeah.
But they have this one journalist who already wrote another article about how Neukölln being dangerous and how Islamist networks in Berlin and in Neukölln specifically are making life impossible in Neukölln for anyone who thinks differently than them. And that article published a few days actually before the Al-Mashadani attack, and I was like, this is like an anti-Neukölln rant that is really embarrassing for the Süddeutsche. And of course, a few weeks later, there was this article, this big report on Mascheleini himself by the same journalist, where I just read it and I was like, oh my God, this guy is a pathological liar. And it was kind of funny.
He claims that Markus Söder invited him to live in Bavaria or something?
Yes. So this is one of the many, many things in the article, which are... The funny thing with the article is actually the Markus Söder thing just sounds so unbelievable by itself. Like, I was called by Markus Söder. He told me the Berlin police will not protect me and I should move to Bavaria.
Who's the president of Bavaria?
Yeah, who's the president of Bavaria? This just sounds crazy. If I was a journalist, and I am a journalist, and someone, and you're going to tell me this story, I'll be like, this is fascinating. Let me check. And I'll call the office of Söder and ask them, hey, was there a phone conversation? And they will say, no.
Right. This relates to some of the things you were saying earlier about German investigations, journalism.
Yeah, it's like the very basic thing of just like collaborating, like this very big issue. It's like, if I'll tell you Merkel called me yesterday and she said she was lonely and she wants to hang out, you'll be like, really? Cool. Let me check that. So I checked that, by the way. Mm-hmm. And they said no.
There was no contact.
So. No contact. I mean, they could have lied, you know, whatever, but like, that should be a part of the article. But he claimed a lot of other things about his biography that all didn't make a lot of sense.
What were some of the red flags?
So he claims that he was very pro-Israeli already in Iraq and was persecuted, actually stayed, like, he was 2 years in prison and was tortured daily in prison for his pro-Israeli approach. And I was like, this sounds very interesting because I have never heard about such cases in Iraq before. Iraq does have a clear laws against normalization with Israel, but still, it just didn't seem fit. He was part of the Iraqi state. He worked as a he claims to have worked for the security ministry, different ones in Iraq. In the same times, he claims to have been in prison and claims to have been threatened, which is actually, you know, people are being threatened in Iraq. But still, there were a lot of things in the story that just sounded off. And they sounded off without me knowing anything. And I was just amazed by the fact that someone can make this interview and not notice this. This sounds unreal. And this is one of the things that, like, always happens to me with German media. Like, there's, like, stories where I was like, don't you understand? This sounds weird. And this was one of those cases. So I, like, start looking around and, like, then I looked at his Facebook. That was exactly, Facebook actually showed me at the same day that I was looking. That's how Facebook works. Showed me this thing where he says there is a network in Berlin by Islamists and Green Party members and Hezbollah and SPD and Hamas and people who work in the institutions. All together, they're called the Army of the Friends of Muhammad. And they are trying to Islamize the town or something like this.
I mean, it sounds like the kind of old specter of Judeo-Bolshevism, but now with an Islamic slant.
Yeah, Islamic slant and just bonkers. Like, it sounds really crazy.
Yeah.
A few days later, he wrote about how he doesn't get his driving license from the driving license authority in Berlin because they are Hamas aligned and he's being punished for his pro-Israeli approach. And this is where I was like, okay, there's some things here that are quite interesting. And also in the Süddeutsche Zeitung, there was actually one interesting detail was that the police was quite reluctant to talk about the case. Mm-hmm. And usually we know that the Berlin police is very happy to talk about cases when it fits their political story and not so much when it's nuts. And they actually, so the fact that the police was quite hesitant was for me a good sign. Okay, wait, maybe this tip that I got that the attack didn't really happen, there's something into it. How do we find it out?
And in your report, you say that you spoke with a police source or somebody that had seen the footage, right? Because when you wrote the thing, had you already seen it?
No, I have not seen the footage. And that was actually the big risk that we were taking.
Yeah.
So I got three different sources telling me about the attack, seeing the video, three different independent sources.
And they'd all seen it.
And they all seen it. And those three different independent sources... then when I had those three and when I knew that the police is actually interrogating El-Mashadani for false accusation, only at that point we got the okay to publish the story.
And were your editors nervous?
Yes. I mean, this is, of course, I was also nervous. I mean, this is the thing. I was looking at this guy and I was like, you know, a lot of the stuff, you know, it's very hard to prove someone is lying about his biography or not telling the truth. I can just say what I see. I can just say there's no proofs, you know. I was working and trying to find out, you know, also doing quite a lot of research in Arabic. What can we find about him? And we did find quite a lot, but nothing that in any way has, well, let's say, not the story that he was telling. Mm-hmm. So, you know, and before you write about someone and you write a story about someone that might, you know, be very damaging to them, I'm also worried. I think it's also something that journalists need to think about. Like when we do damaging stories on individuals, is there anyone there to support them? Mm-hmm. Is there anything that like, you know, so this is also, I think, part of the story is like, are we really sure? Which details am I going to put inside? Do I really need to put the funniest details if they're very embarrassing? And some of the stuff I didn't put inside, right? Like, mm-hmm. I think it's like also a thing of...
But you're willing to say them here today, I hear.
No. I mean, some of the things came out later. I mean, like his writings and his very stupid writings about like, you know, politics and all of his like quite, you know, they came later in other articles.
Yeah.
So anyway, when we published it, we did not see the video. And then the video did come out, was leaked somehow to...
The Tagesspiegel
actually...
They published the footage, and let's hear it very clearly. Like, what is the footage?
So the footage shows very clearly, and also the footage shows very clearly. He is waiting for the U-Bahn. The U-Bahn gets there. The U-Bahn stops. The doors open. He goes inside. A person who comes from the other, on the U-Bahn track, is like goes inside. Probably patches his back and goes out.
Mm-hmm.
That is what we see.
That's it. And I looked at on the Tagesspiegel article, they only have stills.
Mm-hmm.
So you see exactly what you've described. But there was some talk of like a gesture or something that the guy did. Do we think that the guy was being aggressive or friendly, or is it completely unclear what the relationship between these two individuals?
Yeah. So... The Tagesspiegel claims that he was doing a gesture, the supposed attacker, doing a gesture, pointing into his eyes and pointing at him.
Right, like
something exactly.
Like I'm watching you.
So exactly. Clearly some kind of an aggressive gesture.
Mm-hmm.
I would say something that is, if that would happen to me in the U-Bahn, I might feel anxious. I might feel attacked in a way. One could claim it might be criminally relevant or not. This is something for the police to decide. But this was not an attempted murder.
Right.
And not an attack. This is for me the fascinating thing. The police had this video since day two of the attack. So how could it be that the whole Berlin policy, where we were talking about like the rise of anti-Semitism, the attempted murder of a school principal in Neukölln just because he's not against Jews. We have this whole media circus, right? And the police knows this is lies, these are all lies, and says nothing.
And just to be clear about the ways that he was sort of honored, he got a... he got an award from the mayor of Berlin. He was nominated for a Federal Cross of Merit or something from the president of Germany.
So just days before the attack, he got a badge of honor from the city of Berlin. A month after that, he got also by his professor doctor, right? His name was always Professor Dr. Hodef El-Mashadani. He got an award, the Needle of Honor of Ehrennagel of Neukölln. And clearly he was supposed to get more and more prizes, because that's what you do, right? You just give a lot of prizes. This is how the politics shows that they're interested in a person. And all of the mayors, the mayor of Neukölln, the mayor of Berlin, we're talking also about like several politicians from the SPD and from the CDU who courted this guy all the time, are completely quiet and do not speak about the fact that this guy is clearly a fraudster, like clearly... lied about his academic titles, about an attack that did not happen, and that the police knew about this attack that not happening for 4 months. And I want to go back to this thing, because this is a big issue, as a lot of things that happen in Berlin, and we don't know who is the attacker, what's going on. This is very normal, right? There were threats against journalists, for example. There were threats, there were like placards. We don't know who they are. There are conspiracy theories, which I usually dismiss, of saying it's the Israeli lobby itself that does like specific threatening stuff in order to create an atmosphere that will make repressive steps toward Palestinians more plausible.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And there is this false flag.
Like false flags.
False flag ideas all of the time coming up. You hear it quite a lot from activists. And I usually see that as a kind of like very trying to protect yourself, saying our scene would not do this, we are the good ones, this is stupid.
It's too neat somehow.
Too neat, yeah. Like the false flag narrative is usually something I do not follow. In this case, we have clearly, I would not say a false flag, but like clearly, well, I mean, he's the flag and he put the flag in, but it was he's the guy, he lies, he's getting more prizes, mm-hmm. And the police is quiet.
Yeah, and there's no repercussions.
There's no repercussion. No one's been fired for this. The mayor, the head of the police in Berlin can hide this information. She knew about it, clearly. And she hides this for 4 months. You know, I live in Neukölln. And it's also one of these things we talk a lot about, like this idea of like as security feelings. You know, how do we feel? Are we feeling secure? There's a lot of these Jews feel unsafe in Neukölln. You know, people who are, like, you know, when I hear someone is attacked and there's an attempted murder, I feel a little bit unsafe.
Sure.
You know, like I can understand this. But by the way, this was reported in Israeli press as well. Like, as, you know, a pro-Israeli schoolmaster is being attacked. You know, did they ever think like maybe it's better for our safety to tell us this was false?
Yeah.
Why did I need to do this job? Why did I need to do the investigation, right? And this is what really, I think, till today is the point that is not, you know, people like the fraudster, people like the Hochstapler. A story. People like to see this one guy climbs and falls.
Mm-hmm.
The much more worrying thing here is not the guy who climbs and falls, but the institutions who made him climb,
yeah.
awarded him, protected him till the last second, till our article was published, actually.
Mm-hmm.
And actually, till the video was shown.
Yeah. And exactly. I mean, I think that's a great example of exactly like how the network of all these things are ready to amplify someone. And then even after it's shown that he's lied, never really retract that or never kind of overreact. So I suppose the question is like, what do you think this tells us about Berlin and Neukölln today?
Well, it tells us a few things. First of all, I think that the idea is that if there's consequences for anything in Germany, is about lying about your PhD. don't do that. Because that's the only way to get someone down in this country.
but they all do it.
They all do it. But if you catch them, yeah. It's not all of them. So don't lie about your PhD or your professorship.
Right. Don't fake an attack on the U-Bahn.
Don't fake an attack on the U-Bahn. That never happened. Fake it somewhere else. there's more cameras now. Like, you know, be better in faking stuff. Let's put it like this. What I would say, much more interesting, this guy was spreading those crazy conspiracy theories.
Right. Mm-hmm. They want to make one person emblematic of a whole community, yeah. and then hear from them as the authority and then listen to this narrative. And the narrative is often yeah. the one that they've already presumed it was going to
be. Exactly. And this is also the thing. Like when we notice who does German journalists talk with, the most, the Palestinian that is more interviewed than anyone else is Ahmed Mansour, a very pro-Israeli figure, a very Islam critical figure, as they would say. Those kind of people, these kind of like, you know, the heroes out of this community. I'm not saying some of their activities are all false or like, you know, but it's very much clearly journalism should do more mm-hmm. than that.
Okay, that's really interesting. And I also wanted to say there's no one more conspiratorial than someone doing a conspiracy. You know
yeah.
what I mean?
Yeah.
but okay. You used to work in Berlin on like anti-Semitism as a progressive social cause, building coalitions as a kind of community organizer. And do you feel that work just feels for you differently now, or that the cause, which what should be a absolutely, you know, social good, has been sort of weaponized in ways that are, has your feeling about that cause changed because of the German reaction to October 7th and all of the networks that have been activated in its wake?
Yeah, I would say that the fascinating thing of like working on anti-Semitism and racism in Berlin and in Germany in general is that we have censeurs, actually, a form of specialization in anti-Semitism that has something very little to do with Jews. So anti-Semitism, it's like you can go to a university and study Africa studies and anti-racism studies and all of the professors are white. That happens in Germany, by the way, quite often, right? Like it's almost the same as like with anti-Semitism being a part of social theory that has very little to do with Jews. One of the thinkers that I'm very much influenced by on this question is Elad Lapidot, who's a Jewish Israeli philosopher who is a Talmud scholar, actually, and writes a lot about like, you know, how anti-Semitism, just like, is very much a non-Jewish totally. Way of dealing with Jews, and also somehow anti-Semitic by its nature. What I'm trying to say by this is like that anti-Semitism, the idea of what is anti-Semitism is, was always very much detached from the Jewish lived experience in Berlin, my own communities that I'm a part of. I mean, it's always quite ridiculous for me that like I'm surrounded by Jews quite a lot in Neukölln. As a self-hating Jew as I am, like I have quite a lot of Jewish friends and like and Hebrew-speaking friends. And like, you know, I just, and like this idea of like living under constant fear, being oppressed, it's just not the way we live reality. And understanding that this kind of discourse, the German discourse, has very little to do with us. I think that kind of view was very clear through this activism. And it's, I would say October 7 more or less made it a little bit more acute in a lot of ways, but it was already there before. And what we do see, and this is also connected to the Mashudan thing, is like anti-Semitism became an industry. And fighting anti-Semitism, we're talking about millions of state money and non-state money being pushed into what is called Antisemitismus Bekämpfung, the struggle, the battle against anti-Semitism, which is most of the beneficiaries of this are non-Jews, mm-hmm. which is fascinating for me. You know, it would have been much cheaper to just like give every Jew in Germany like 2,000 euros than yearly. Then we're not so many here, by the way. No, we're like 100,000.
Yeah, yeah.
20, maybe 120,000. Anyway, then actually, you know, supporting these huge industries of like so-called experts. And with this kind of experts, experts on extremism, experts on anti-Semitism, all of those experts, a lot of them are not actually experts on anything.
Experts on digital hate who then appear to be being quite hateful online. And
yeah, exactly. So we see it actually right now with the big scandal that is going on in Berlin with how these monies are being distributed, you know? And like a lot of these monies goes to people that are fraudulent in many ways and are actually very hateful and have a very clear agenda, which is pro-war and anti-migration, or at least anti-Islam. And this kind of industry and like this kind of like state power that is being assumed by this has very little to do, not entirely nothing, but very little with actual Jewish life in Neukölln or in Berlin. And this is for me also the interesting story here. It's like we have many Jews in Neukölln, we have many Jews in Berlin that are not part of these discussions, that are not being asked to comment. There's only specific organizations that speak in their names. And this is also, and the stage is being taken by, you know, Professor Dr. Hudef El-Mashadani or some other people with like weird claims to their expertise that are, I would say, questionable at best.
Yeah, I think it's a really good point how the networks that try to combat anti-Semitism often sort of bypass, ignore, or even kind of completely aren't responsive to Jewish voices. You know, like they're not interested, actually. It's much easier to worry about Jews without asking them. But yeah, I suppose, do you think living in Neukölln today and working on this subject, do you see any causes for optimism? You know, it's been a bleak couple of years. Do you see anything changing or progressing?
So I would say one thing that I was surprised by in my article, specifically on Mashudani, that there were consequences. It's very clear. First of all, Neukölln doesn't call him a professor doctor anymore on their website. There is probably a police interrogation into some of his claims against him. Some politicians had to distance themselves somehow from him. So we do see that, you know, reporting does actually have consequences. And even the Bild-Zeitung or like even the Springer had to report on the issue, of course, without mentioning that we were the first of doing it. But still, I'm very happy that they did. Even the Jüdische Allgemeine had to report on it. So those things happen. And I think we can see also with the anti-Semitism scandal right now, with this funding scandal, that there is actually reporting and there is some consequences for some of the most, you know, ridiculous violations of funding that is going on. So in that sense, I would say it's very important to keep on looking. And I, you know, it's a lot of this work is done. Like I'm, you know, I did this work with my with a colleague, Daniel Bax, who works a lot on Islamophobia in and write about it for many years. But I also, you know, a lot of this work is done by talking with different activists and journalists. And there's what I think is quite interesting that we have a network of journalists in Berlin that is very supportive of each other, specifically because the situation for journalism is so dire when it comes to those issues. So I'm talking here today, but like, I mean, I'm not, you know, by myself. So that is kind of a way of to see optimism. And I also think, you know, things will change. And we have another election coming up. Maybe some of the political parties that were very much involved with this kind of stuff will be voted out of government. One can hope so.
You think we'll have a new mayor in Neukölln?
Everything is possible in Neukölln. I think it's one of the main things I would say that is very needed is also for non-German citizens also to vote. Not a lot of people know it, but if you're a European citizen, sadly not UK.
Not me, yeah.
But Irish people and anyone else from the European Union can vote in the local elections in Neukölln. So do. Yeah, if you can, yeah. Mm-hmm. And anywhere else, of course, in the city, not just Neukölln. You can't vote for the mayor of like the Berlin elections, but you can vote for the local district elections.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, thanks very much for coming, Josip Bartal. Go read his stuff in TAT, in the Diasporist, and anything else that's
Neues Deutschland.
Sorry?
Neues Deutschland.
Yeah,
and Freitag. It was great being here. Thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you.
Bye.
Thanks for listening to the Heist podcast. We want to say thanks again to Josip Bartal for his time. Check out his whole article on heistberlin.com. You can also, don't forget, check out the other two episodes that we published to properly launch the podcast. One with Heba Jamal about Palestinian life in Berlin after October 7th, and one with Ben Miller about the AFD and weaponizing queer politics. But yeah, thanks again for listening. You can sign up for Heist at heistberlin.com. Check us out on Instagram. We really appreciate you helping us spread the word and getting this podcast going. We'll be back in 2 weeks with another episode. See you then.